ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
And a demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Australia banned under-16s from social media at the start of summer, and the world has been watching. It's autumn now. The compliance numbers are impressive on paper. One in five teenagers are still on TikTok and Snapchat. Two actual 15-year-olds are suing the government. And someone passed an age check with their dog. Today, we're doing a full audit. What the ban is doing, what it isn't, and whether we even built it on the right foundations. My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. And joining me to unpack everything that's happened with the social media ban since it came into place is Jocelyn Brewer, psychologist and founder of Digital Nutrition. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ray.
And Josh Taylor, technology reporter for The Guardian. Welcome back, Josh.
Great to be back.
Now, Josh, take me back. What exactly changed on December 10 for under-16s in Australia?
So that was the date when the platforms had to have age assurance in place and have basically identified and kicked off all the accounts that were identified as being under 16. And we know for the 10 platforms that were named, and the legislation is broad enough that, like, even if you weren't named, you potentially should be looking at if it should apply to you. But the 10 platforms that were covered said that they deactivated around 4.7 million accounts in those first couple of days. And it's sort of since fluctuated a little bit. We don't really have any more data, but those are the platforms where the kids were sort of having their accounts removed. And that was sort of, you know, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, everything like that.
I'll call it out from the beginning. We call it the social media ban. Everyone calls it the social media ban. When you go on the eSafety Commissioner website, they call it a delay, not a ban. Straight up say it's a delay. Jocelyn, what's the reasoning there? Should we be calling it a delay for this episode?
Well, you can call it whatever you like, I guess, because the reality and what we'll get to is whether or not a ban or a delay is actually successful in doing what it's supposed to. But I guess using the word ban around a young person probably is a little bit salacious, a bit like a red rag to a bull. Oh, you banned it. Let me see how I can continue to use that thing. So I guess the idea too here was that the minimum age, so to speak, was supposed to be 13, and it was delaying that age or raising the age to 16. So I think this is a little bit of linguistics or semantics to try and kind of get our head around. You're not off it forever, but we're delaying that in order to protect young minds, let's say.
So some platforms were included. Josh, you listed a bunch there. Some weren't, even though from the outside they seem functionally the same, doing the same thing. So who is drawing up this list? What was the logic behind what would be included in the delay and what wouldn't?
I think it was basically the government sort of identifying platforms that it wanted it to apply to and basically saying you need to go through this process to determine if it should apply to you or not. And, you know, they named all the different ones that they thought were applicable. And, you know, there was a lot of controversy over whether YouTube should be included. And famously, Reddit is also launching a high court challenge against its inclusion. But those were the sort of first 10. It's been notable that there have been other platforms that were not named, like Blue Sky, that has basically put on age verification itself as a result, because it sort of assessed that it was, defined as a social media platform under the legislation, even though eSafety was sort of talking that it was relatively low risk. But they obviously thought that it was potential that they may be included at some point in time, or they may be in breach if they weren't doing this, so they've done it. But they basically just sort of decided that those 10 platforms were the most important. I thought it was interesting, particularly because, you know, Instagram was doing a lot of things around teen accounts and things like that, trying to make it so that it could potentially escape the ban. But I think the government wanted to be strong in the first instance and basically say, these are the 10 platforms we're applying for. We may add some more later, but these are the ones we're going for now.
Yeah, and I think there's really specific criteria here for what a social media platform is defined as and the primary purpose of that. And you can go back and nerd out and read that in the legislation. But those age-restricted platforms, I mean, we didn't even know what that definition was going to be. So there were examples of these sandboxed platforms like Instagram teen accounts, which were released way before the legislation came into place.
The government announcing those 4.7 million accounts that were deactivated in the first half of December, what can we actually make from those numbers? Is this really 4.7 million kids off social media? Can we say that definitively?
Well, not without context. How many accounts actually exist? How many young people were already on there? Did we have an estimate of that? How many new accounts were created directly after being pushed out of your old one? So this number on its own, I guess, for me, doesn't really mean very much unless we have bigger context and other numbers to compare it to.
Also, it's like completely devoid of context because basically all they asked the platforms was how many Australian users did you have before the ban came into effect and how many do you have after? And so that includes a whole bunch of accounts that it may have deactivated on their own. It's a whole bunch of accounts that may have never been used. I know that in like YouTube, for example, there were accounts that sort of Google accounts that had never actually used YouTube that were sort of deactivated. So it's not really a particularly reliable number. It's a nice headline, but it doesn't actually tell us very much.
So it wasn't even specific to accounts that were owned by under 16-year-olds either.
No. My understanding was because the other thing was that there would have been a lot of accounts where the kids might say that they were, you know, 18, 19, but then through their age verification were shown to be under 16. So like they couldn't really sort of draw sort of any sort of meaningful data from that because those accounts would have appeared to be older than they were.
There is some new research that's showing one in five 13 to 15-year-olds are still on TikTok and Snapchat, and those numbers are starting to creep up after an initial drop there as well. So looking at these kinds of numbers and also anecdotally as well, is the delay working, Jocelyn?
If you're defining working by like literally the number of accounts, then I don't think that's working because what we're also not talking about is how many kids were on Yope and some of these other platforms that skyrocketed in the App Store as, you know, safe, inverted commas, alternatives. And we don't have data on that, for instance. So simply from are kids on social media more or less, I would say my kind of anecdotal and some of the research I'm reading is there's been a very minor shift. And that minor shift, I mean, it's early days, right? Like in terms of big social shift around accepting that younger people, their use of social media really needs to be supported and carefully looked at. It's early days, but if we're just looking at numbers, we're missing so much complexity and context of where positive use actually happens and what other, as you say, the platforms that are currently not in the age restrictions but are possibly going to be scooped up and are on notice and are attempting to do some age verification, we still are missing so much of the complexity of and the richness of what kids and all of us do online by, really simplifying this into online or not on.
And outside of that number of, you know, the 4.7 million accounts that were deactivated, Josh, has the government published any compliance data on this? Do we have any more verifiable information?
No. So the next round of questions that went to the platforms after the initial account deactivations was around the compliance measures. What are they doing to make sure that kids are staying off, they're deactivating accounts and not registering new accounts? And that process is underway, and we don't have any data on that yet. I think that'll be the next sort of signpost. But as you're saying, anecdotally, like everyone knows someone whose teen is still on like one of these platforms or was able to get around it. And I've had numerous emails from parents who said, you know, my son's account is remained online and I've tried to get it deactivated and I can't do it. And that was one of the other things that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be able to basically dob in your kid's account to the platforms if you wanted it deactivated. But in one instance when I reported it, someone reported to Snapchat and was basically told, well, the account looks 25. There's nothing in the account behavior that suggests it's under 25, so we can't do anything. It was only after I sent sort of media inquiries to Snapchat that they actually went through and deactivated it.
Incredible. Using your media power for good, Josh. Thank you.
I'm always tech support for those social media platforms in a lot of ways.
Meanwhile, I'm trying to start a whole new project on one of the platforms. And even when uploading my license with a 70s date of birth cannot get on.
Really?
They didn't accept my driver's license.
They believe you're under 16.
I hope they do. I'm going back to class right after this.
So before we get into how exactly kids are getting around this ban, this delay, what were they actually using these platforms for? Because I think the public conversation tends to reduce social media to doom scrolling and cyberbullying, but I believe it's far more complicated than that. Jocelyn?
Look, young people do a million things. Screen time is not one thing. It's a lot of different things, and it changes from kid to kid because of the way the algorithm might serve them their interests. So what I know that lots of young people are doing is following their interests and following their passions. And there's some really great research that says when you actually skill kids up on curating their feed and really shaping that out to meet their interests, that has positive effects because they're actually role modeled really great stuff. So it's much more than that doom scrolling brain rot. There's a lot of conversations, there's a lot of collaborations. They make a lot of things too. My daughter is now coming up to me saying, "Mom, I've got this great idea. Will you film this and put this on your Instagram?" And I say, "We can film it and we can share it with our family." You're 9, not yet. But there's lots of different ways that kids really very organically want to kind of share and connect. I always talk about social media not being addictive. Like, we're not addicted to the platform. We're addicted to one another and the connection that we get through being able to share to a bigger audience at one point.
Oh, that's a really lovely way to think about it. We're addicted to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so much nicer. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And I'm joined by Josh Taylor, technology reporter for The Guardian, and Jocelyn Brewer, who is a psychologist and founder of Digital Nutrition. Now, I spoke with John Livingston from UNICEF Australia about what they're hearing from young people on the ban. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken with thousands of young people across the country, and they describe social media as, you know, a bit of a double-edged sword. And by that, I mean, yes, they acknowledge that there's plenty of awful and bad stuff online. They see awful content. There's bullying and stuff like that. But on the other side of the sword, you know, it's a place where they find connection. They chat with their family and friends, where they find community and like-minded young people, and also where they find, you know, crucial support for things like their health and mental health. So very mixed views, but something that young people all agree on, actually, it seems, is that they recognize that the online world can be better, that there are things they would like to see change to make the online world a better place.
That was John Livingston there from UNICEF Australia. And I also spoke to some kids myself, because someone has to.
I feel like it didn't make us think too hard about whether the platforms were good or bad. I think it made us more feel like defensive towards them, because for a lot of us they're kind of like communities and they kind of give you a way to connect with people. And I think most adults didn't fully understand that, and the fact that we didn't have input on the ban itself kind of made that a little bit harder too.
Do you think there should have been more conversations with young people before the ban came into place?
Absolutely. They're the ones banning us from it. You can't ban someone and not talk to someone about it, being like, "Oh, this is why we're banning it." No one really, people understood, but they never sat us down and really explained, "This is why we're banning you from it." I feel like there could have been other ways they could have gone around it, by like going into schools and actually teaching us about online bullying and all the different aspects that is wrong with social media and how to like steer clear of that, or like teach us effectively and not just kind of go, "Oh, no, mine now, no longer yours, sorry."
So we had a chat with a couple of teenagers that say the delay hasn't really changed much for them. They're fine. Is that the answer that kids give when an adult points a microphone at them, or does it actually match what you're both hearing?
I mean, so I've been sort of checking in with Headspace, the mental health group, and they say sort of I think it's 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 that of people who are showing up to the centres are sort of bringing up the social media ban as sort of part of the reason why they're attending. So it's very quite small, but basically the teens that we've spoken to at The Guardian, and you know, just anecdotally in my own life, I like most kids I know have been able to get around it, have been able to find other ways, and sort of the feedback we're hearing is that if kids do go off it, they are all going off collectively. They're finding, like, they're moving into WhatsApp group chats and things like that, or something like that. But there's sort of, a bit of a mixed success, because there are, you know, phases where one kid might be able to get around it, but another kid won't, and they've got FOMO now. You know, in a household where there's one teen who's over 16 and another who's under, they're left out. So it's just a really mixed bag at the moment, and it's really hard to sort of measure how successful it is, because it is still very early days.
So, Josh, can you just walk us through how age verification actually technically works on these platforms? Because most people have no idea what's happening on the other end when a teenager and the rest of us have to point a phone at our faces to work out whether or not we are of age to use Instagram.
Well, I mean, for most of us, you know, those of us who are over 16, you know, I've had a Facebook account since Kevin Rudd was last Prime Minister, it didn't have to do a facial age check on me, because it looked at the account activity and determined that I was definitely over 16. And I think that was the experience for a lot of people who had existing accounts on these platforms, that they kind of sense your account behavior, and if there are signals there saying, look, this person's been on the platform a long time, they're not interested in, you know, K-pop Demon Hunters or something that the kids are interested in, they're probably over 16. That's sort of the basic measure. But then they go down to, if they're not sure, then you'll have to go through some sort of facial age estimator. So it's basically takes a scan of your face, like a video selfie basically, where it processes it using AI to see how it matches up against other people who are similar age demographics, and gives you a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and hopefully then the image gets deleted, but we'll see how that goes. And then the flow on from that is, if you fail it and you still challenge the sort of ruling on that, then you go to providing a form of ID, and that's sort of the last measure that they go through. So it means uploading, you know, your government ID or something.
We saw recently downloads of virtual private networks, or VPNs, go absolutely through the roof, mostly driven by adults still wanting to get onto adult websites but not wanting to provide, say, their passport in order to do so. So, Josh, is using a VPN working to avoid the ban for people?
Yeah, I think it is definitely much more for the adult websites than it is for the social media websites, because they essentially, a lot of these social media sites use device imprinting and things like that. So if you have the Facebook app on your phone and you suddenly change your location into like Zambia or something like that, it'll like...
Red flags.
Yeah, it will basically say, no, you're actually still Australian, so we can't get it through. So that seems to be less of an issue. Like, I think that I've been tracking sort of the VPN Google search trends, and it's way, way higher when these pornography codes came in than it was when the social media ban came in. So I think a lot of kids, they may have been trying it. Maybe they're trying it when they're setting up new accounts on new devices, but at the moment it just seems that it's less of an issue with the social media ban. They're finding other ways around it that don't involve VPNs.
Anecdotally, I have noticed that kids are actually more distressed about the changes to access to pornography than they were the social media ban.
Really?
There is a range of young people who have regular use of pornography, and that when they were kicked out, that was actually much more effective of removing them from sites than the social media ban was. And for some of them who were in relationships and who needed to talk about this and were really struggling with that, they have gone to their partners, girlfriends, all those sorts of things, young men, to talk about their loss. And they then, you know, go to their school counsellor and say, what do I do about this? So that's a really fascinating thing that only in the last couple of weeks, because it was only the 9th of March that this started actually coming into play, that actually has been probably a more significant thing in that short period of time than the social media ban has in my work.
I'm wondering if we're going to see a rise of analogue pornography stashes in the bushes down by the river near the school, like the good old days.
Yeah, if somebody's still printing that, I'm sure.
Getting around the ban, though, has also become a bit of a social activity for kids in itself. You know, they're sharing techniques, they're gathering in places to be able to work out how to get around it. What do you think that tells us about how kids are processing this?
Yeah, again, the larrikins, they're problem solvers. In a couple of years, they'll probably be called entrepreneurs. They're probably, you know, innovating in their own different ways. And again, they're the kids we really need to connect with and understand why and what need that's meeting. It reminds me when smartphone bans were came into schools, and there were these Yonder pouches where kids literally just went onto Amazon, bought for $15 the magnet to unlock them, and then would sell unlocks for $2. Or they would just have burner phones and all of that sort of stuff. And again, we're not planning or thinking about how young people's minds work. We're not actually talking to them. We're just thinking, oh yes, we're stopping you access this thing, and you know, you will now go and please ride your bike, which probably brings us to a whole nother area of like, go and ride your bike, but not like that. Not an like e-bike.
Not an e-bike and not in public. Yeah, get outside, kids. Wait, not like that. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Rae Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Jocelyn Brewer, who is a psychologist and the founder of Digital Nutrition, and Josh Taylor, technology reporter for The Guardian. And yeah, let's talk about whether any of this is actually solving the right problem. Now, to verify age, platforms are now collecting facial scans, government IDs, you know, bank details sometimes from the general population at scale. Is that trade-off being talked about seriously enough, given we're handing biometric data in some cases to the very companies that we apparently don't trust with our kids' well-being? It just seems a bit hypocritical.
A lot of the larger platforms are using sort of third-party providers and I've spoken to a lot of these companies before it came in. They're promising to sort of, once they do the face scan, they delete it. You know, once they check the license, they then delete it. We are relying on a lot on promises, but a lot of these, the larger platforms at least, appear to be trying to do data minimization as sort of requirement of the legislation as well. But I think the issue may come up with some of the smaller platforms that maybe not doing sort of the same systems. We saw this happen with Discord when they started introducing age verification, and when people wanted to appeal certain findings, a lot of the ID documentation was getting sent to a third party who then suffered a data breach. So, you know, we just have to really be careful when we're putting our information into all these different places.
And it's deeply unsexy to want to like learn about privacy and data security, right?
How dare you, Jocelyn? How dare you?
Well, you know, that's why we have 97 pages of terms and conditions that everyone just says, yes, I've read that.
But 6 weeks. It would take you 6 working weeks to read all the terms and conditions we agree to every year.
Exactly, right? So when it comes to, I want to be on this platform and all my friends are there, we are, you know, literally ticking yes to do, or, you know, uploading our lives to these third parties that we know nothing about, except that if you know, really pay attention, half of the companies get breached. Like, name a company that hasn't been breached. Even, you know, when you walk into your RSL and you scan your license, that company got breached. So I think too, at this point, many people don't really care anymore because they feel like they've been feeding it for ages and it's just part of what you pay to play, so to speak. You trade that in order to participate.
I think the biggest concern that has been raised with me is again around the adult sites verification thing, because that, you know, it would be not hard for someone to basically set up a honeypot type porn website where, you know, they're collecting your personal information to say you can come in, but then they also get all this information on like your sexuality, the things that you're interested in sexually, and they could use that to collect all this information on someone and then try to blackmail them on it. And I think that is like one of the unintended side effects. If everyone gets used to all this verification on adult sites, then they could potentially become a victim to something like that.
Now, this entire law was built on the premise that social media harms kids. How solid is that foundation, really?
This law is built on the premise that what Jonathan Haidt wrote in At the Anxious Generation was watertight.
I'm collapsing on the floor in a heap. Jocelyn.
That's my basic summary, right? It was one book that a South Australian premier read, or his wife read, and said, this is a really good book, guys. We should make some laws around it. Everyone, please read the book. And many of the research community have rallied against using that as it's oversimplified and sometimes pretty shambolic way of setting such important laws that we, I'm not anti-delaying social media. Like, actually, I've worked on trying to get people to have good digital habits for the last 15 years.
The clue's in the name, digital nutrition.
Yeah. But I think ultimately, which are the harms that we're protecting against? And we can't erase harms from our lives completely. We can minimize them and we can teach people how to spot them and then the skills you need to overcome them. But when it comes to actually defining the problem, like, are we trying to get rid of cyberbullying? Well, good luck, because you need to actually get rid of bullying to begin with. And where do we see that most? In our parliament, by the people who made these laws. So I like really struggle with this, you know, and anyone who knows me knows this struggle because I don't stop talking about it. But yeah, look, there's so much research that points to moderate use that is, you know, supported by parents, where you have good relationships, you have good sleep, you have a range of other factors, mean that the impact of social media use is probably very minimal. And, you know, Patrick McGorry from Headspace and Origin would concur that.
If you want a really good debunking deep dive of the anxious generation, If Books Could Kill does an excellent breakdown of it. We will not attempt to do that work because it has already been done.
Absolutely.
Highly recommend you give that a listen.
I would just say as well, Jonathan Haidt recently said, he's been asked about how the Australian ban is going, and he basically said that we need to wait 5 years and they need to make sure that 70% of children are actually complying with the ban in order for it to be effective. And so if in 5 years we see no change in sort of mental health outcomes like that, he will potentially admit that he was wrong, but I guess we'll have to see what happens in the next 5 years.
And we would have to get at least 70% compliance for those numbers to be something that he will consider.
So, yeah, okay. So legislation that was passed in 9 days and had very little scrutiny, we now need to wait 5 years to see whether it works.
Well, it's almost like there's trials for these things usually before they're put into legislation.
I mean, technically we'll have some information in too, because the Stanford-led advisory committee that's going to review all of this, which again has some really awesome researchers, will look at a range of different things. But again, very complex, and how we sort of make sure there's not confounding variables like antidepressant prescribing of young people.
Now, the Australian Human Rights Commission argued that a better approach would be placing a legal duty of care on the platforms themselves, requiring them to make their products safe rather than restricting who can access them. Josh, why didn't that happen?
Well, I mean, the government is promising a digital duty of care to come, you know, in the coming months and years potentially. But I really think it did put the cart before the horse, because, you know, as we were sort of discussing before, I think that all of the issues that we're talking about in terms of the bad outcomes for teenagers also affect every other sort of generation. You know, we all know someone who's had their brain cooked by being on X for too long. You know some boomers who have been scammed on Facebook. So a lot of the harms that are happening online are happening to everyone, not just teens. And ideally, a digital duty of care would address those things, not just for teenagers, but for everyone else as well.
And this was recommended by the Senate committee. So when we got that half a day to like scrutinise the legislation, the Senate committee said, can we do the digital duty of care as well? And that was then not included. So we had the opportunity. It was a big step. It was really bold, and it will be bold when we do it, because in effect, rather than saying under 16s cannot drive in these 10 makes of cars, the digital duty of care should mandate seatbelts and safety features on all cars for all drivers. And that's what we need.
Oh, I love that analogy so much, Jocelyn. Jocelyn Brewer, Josh Taylor, thank you both so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for this week. Make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss future episodes of Download This Show. And thank you for all of your thoughts and your feedback. You can send them over to downloadthisshow@abc.net.au or drop a review and a rating on your favourite podcasting platform. Now, if you liked what John Livingston from UNICEF had to say, we will drop his full interview Wednesday next week. I'm Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.